Okay, I've got some questions here. I'm going to pick, there's one that I want to start off with, because what is your definition of God? Well, I have, what, 15 seconds? No, I'm not going to give you my definition of God, but I will tell you what Thomas Keating says, which I just think is absolutely profound. He says, remember that anything you say about God is more unlike God than like God. Anything you say about God is more unlike God than like God. And actually, I've taken that one step further, or one step back, depending upon your point of view. The realization that anything I say about Patrick or anybody else is probably more unlike Patrick than like Patrick. You know, isn't that, we probably all experience, the older and smarter we get, the less we realize we know. So anyway, I don't know who asked that question. I hope that this is, God will not be defined. Although, I think it was in Keating's book, he does have one definition that I think is really good. And he refers to God simply as presence. As presence. And so in the sense that we experience God in every, because there's always presence. So I like that thought. Something that occurs is people saying that they don't believe in God. And we get a lot of this in AA. Guys coming in and they hear this guy talking, they say, I didn't come here to hear about God. I don't believe God stuff, you know, that sort of thing. One such fellow came in that way 14 years ago, and a couple of years ago came up and handed me an envelope. Two of them, actually, one for myself and the other was for Father Jack up at St. Mary's. And inside the envelope was an invitation to his daughter's baptism. Yeah. So transformation had taken place. But my take on people who say they don't believe in God is simply this, that the God they don't believe in fact, probably doesn't exist. You know, because people have grown up with people, you know, adults or religious people telling them about who and what God is, and they get up, they grow up and say, you know what? I don't think so. So they decide they're not going to believe in that concept of God and think that then they are rejecting or not believing in God. And all they've done is decide that a concept of God which wasn't theirs to begin with probably isn't true. And they're absolutely right. So whenever I encounter that, I just kind of always assume, well, probably the God you don't believe in doesn't exist, and I wouldn't believe in that God either. Makes for wonderful conversations. Okay, let's see. What is your take on being a mystic? What percent of people today are mystics? Not a clue. Not a clue. I'm not even sure I could define what a mystic is. I know Rohr talks about that and has a definition. I would say it's not something I would strive to become. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but again, it's one of those things like my ego would just love for me to be known as a mystic. I'm a mystic. Ego. All ego. If there's some aspect of mysticism that, and maybe it has occurred in my life. In fact, I would guess it probably has. But it's not the point. If those moments have been important for God to have me experience, I've had them. And it's not for Patrick. It's because somehow or another those moments will have helped Patrick be a better servant. Not about Patrick at all. So that's about the best answer I can give. Maybe to some extent or another, we've all had some kind of experience that could be understood as being mystical. Wouldn't surprise me. Doesn't Rory talk about unitive experiences? And we're reading a book now up St. Mary's on unitive experiences. And we probably have all had them, but it's one of those things, as soon as you think you're having one, you're not. So, okay. Oh, this is going to be good. What is your take on the diversification of traditional Catholicism occurring today? Especially St. Anthony community, married clergy, beatitude, community women, presiders. They're very diverse. Now, I think the biggest mistake we can make is getting into judgment on any of that. As far as I'm concerned, time for judgment is over. It's not our job. It's not our job to be judging. You know, Christ made it so clear. What are you doing worrying about the speck in somebody else's eye when you've got a beam in your own? There's some teachings of Christ that just seems to have a hard time making it to the surface. That's one of them. I know people in alternative kinds of Catholic communities, and they are serving their purpose. And it's not for Patrick to judge. This is what we talked about at the beginning. One of those instincts is the identification with a group. If they're not of us, they're against us. Not the truth. Not the truth. So I think taking the lead from Pope Francis, who says, "Who am I to judge?" I would say, you know, let's stop worrying about what's different. There's too much good that we're all trying to be involved with. Let's appreciate that. So anyway, that's my take. Okay, well, those were easy. God, mysticism, diversity. Oh, no, here's one more that's very, really good. I'm not the way that I'm supposed to be. God provides. How can I just sit there? What about motivation? Is that whoever asked this, was motivation? What about motivation? Okay, I think that's probably what this word is. Very good question. We're kind of so programmed that if I say God is going to take care of fixing me, that feels so uncomfortable, because it's like, aren't I supposed to be doing something? Huh? The centering prayer we talked about, that 20-minute sit, you know what the hardest thing about that is? It's not doing anything. I'm not thinking, I'm not figuring out, I'm not doing Lectio Divina, I'm not doing this or that. Now, none of those, there's nothing wrong with any of those things, but this is a particular form of prayer where we're not doing any of those things. We are letting go and letting God. And we're just sitting. Letting God. That's very difficult. Most of the time, after I've had my sit, and it's over, the first feeling that comes is, well, that was a waste of time. Because Patrick wasn't doing something. And it's so hard for Patrick to get it. God doesn't need for Patrick to be doing anything other than putting his rear end on the chair and keeping it there. That's it. That's all God wanted me to do. Thomas Keating says, the only thing you can do wrong is not sit down or get up. So, and here's another take on this. When I identify some area of my life that I recognize is a sin, a fault, failing, whatever it is, I can recognize Patrick can't fix it. Only God can. But here's something Patrick can do with grace. I can identify the opposite behavior. If I weren't doing this thing that's a sin, what would be the opposite behavior? So let us say my sin is selfishness. Okay, what would be the opposite behavior? Generosity. So while God's taking care of my selfishness, I'm going to make a commitment that once a day I will give of something that I have to somebody else. I will be generous. So that's what I'm going to do. And I'll let God take care of getting rid of my selfishness. So I commit myself to an opposite behavior and let God worry about taking away the defect. So there's that I think is useful. So it's not a question of not doing anything. It's just a question of knowing what I can and can't do. And letting God do. What was the original sin? What was the sin that Eve and Adam were guilty of? Why did they eat the apple? They wanted to be like God. That's what the serpent told them. Eat this apple, you're going to be just like God. Wow, that's cool. We're still eating that damn apple. We're still trying to be like God. And what amazes me about that story is it's thousands of years old. What an insight into the human nature and into spirituality that even thousands of years ago, there was that insight as told in the story of we keep trying to be what we're not. We keep trying to be like God when in fact we're not. Isn't that amazing that that insight was there thousands and thousands of years ago? And we're still doing it today. Every time I try and control me or control somebody else, what I'm doing is I'm eating the apple. I'm trying to be like God once again. And what happens when we eat the apple and try and be like God? Get kicked out of paradise. I get frustrated. I get mad. I get fearful. And I ruin my day. Got kicked out of paradise. If I'd only give up trying to be God, I'd spend a lot more time in paradise. In paradise. Okay. So, Bob, do people come up and ask questions? Is that?
Yes. Anybody have any questions?
Would you please tell us the name of the Thomas Keating book you recommended?
Yes. Can I write it down here? That's okay. Well, then the answer is? You already ordered it. Yes. Okay. Divine Therapy and Addiction. Now, I've talked to the people over at Chaucer's, and they've been keeping, they usually have had some. I don't think they order a whole bunch of them, but they do keep one or two. Usually, if I go in there, I can't keep a copy of it. I got it on my iPad. That's the only way I can keep a copy of it, because it's one of those books that you have to give away. Yeah. Nice to see you, Susan.
One of the takeaways from Roar, and especially what you said about Alcoholics Anonymous processes, is for me the importance of learning to live honestly mm-hmm. and to admit who I am as honestly as I can and live with that. And that is a kind of powerlessness because, okay. I couldn't help but, as you were describing those instincts too, I couldn't help but think of the huge scandal we've all lived through with the bishops. I think they were too identified with the good of what they saw as the good of the church, and they couldn't admit honestly that we were that all of that terrible stuff was happening.
Yeah.
And so they hid it. And the result of that for me is I think there's a lot of people, and it's rampant in our society to a degree, is people are living with a lot of shame.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we deal with that? How do we, I mean, I feel ashamed of what happened in the church. And I wasn't directly necessarily a part of it, but I and we have a lot of things going on in our society where people are shamed on the internet and all kinds of things. Do you have any insight into how to deal with shame?
Well, first of all, it's not the church's problem. They are only mirroring Patrick. So I'm a little better off if I'm focusing my attention on how do I deal when I am aware of what my sins are. Do I feel shame? Yes. What is shame? Shame says has to do with I am not right. So how do I deal with my shame? Is go back to what we were talking about earlier. The fact that I have sins does not mean I am not right. It means I'm just the way God would have me be, and I have sins. That's how I can deal with my own personal shame. And if I can get that, then I can let other people have their sin. And not have to, you know, get all upset about other people's sins. So that when I there's in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, they talk about this, and they say that one of the things that we have to remember is that when somebody wrongs us, that they like ourselves. That's a wonderful phrase. They like ourselves are sick too. And so we ask God to give us the grace to treat them as we would any sick friend. We would never visit a sick friend and castigate them for being sick. We wouldn't do that. So if I'm pointing my finger at somebody, it's because I'm making them unlike me, and right away I've lied. because this is Patrick. Does that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So if I'm shaming somebody else, at the root of my behavior is oh my God, what am I doing to me? If I'm shaming you, you can better believe that I'm doing a masterful job of shaming myself first. And that's where I need to focus my attention. Yeah.
Okay, ice cream cone. I thought you were from St. Mary's, but now I know different.
Say
you
again?
You are from St. Mary's on the top of the hill, not the St. Mary's below the
Correct.
Hill. Okay.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Gloria, and welcome.
Thank you.
I was in Al-Anon for many, many years, and so this is wonderful hearing all this. I guess it's not a difference, it's just another way maybe of explaining something. I think the more I become aware and have a fuller consciousness, the more I am aware of my behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
Because to me there's a difference between a behavior and a soul of a person.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think it's when we point the finger and say, you, we're saying the whole person is bad.
Mm-hmm.
Versus when you did this... Da, 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 and you
Absolutely
fell into
correct.
The swimming pool. We all saw you fall in. And you had a beer in your hand as you fell in. There's something wrong there.
Would you have fallen in if you hadn't had that beer in your hand?
And I was thinking about... So for me it is... I think what I really agree with is not shaming ourselves, but noticing it and forgiving ourselves like we want to forgive other people.
Yeah.
It's not always easy, but it's like when we hear talks like this, I think it becomes, at least for me, more present in how much I miss those 12 steps.
Yeah.
I remember the 12 steps in, well, the 12 steps in general. It says character defects, in which one? Is it made a list?
In the sixth step, we become entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. And the seventh step, humbly ask God to do so.
And
fourth step is take a fearless and thorough moral inventory of ourselves.
Well, one is character and defects, and then it becomes shortcomings. So,
both terms are used, and they're meant to be understood as meaning the same thing.
Well, it seems character is bigger than shortcomings.
Uh-huh.
You know, once you've said it to God.
That's one of those topics. So there's two of the steps. When one of the steps, it's became entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. The next step says, humbly ask them to remove our shortcomings.
There's a conversation
about why is there a difference. And Bill Wilson addressed that, who wrote the 12 steps, and he said his English teacher told him not to use the same words twice.
Well, and naturally they had a big discussion about it.
Made a big theological, discussion of, and he said it's very simple. I just didn't want to use the same term twice.
Well, I think it turned out pretty good.
Yeah.
The other thing I'm thinking about is that, see if I can form this. Didn't Bill come to, I remember I was alive when he was alive. When did he pass away, Bill Wilson?
70.
Yes, I was alive.
Mid-70s,
okay.
Yeah.
Very much. I was four, but I was alive. I think he talked about emotional.
Oh, yes.
That was something he needed to do more. I don't know how he put it, but that was his big.
There's an article that he wrote called Emotional Sobriety, the Next Frontier. It's a masterful, and you don't have to be an AA to get it. In fact, it's a lot about what we were talking about. It's a masterful piece that you can Google, Emotional Sobriety, the Next Frontier.
Okay.
I've actually got it here, but there's not time to read it. But it is it's a good little piece to read and chew up and reflect on. Yes, yeah. Bill Wilson was the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Good morning.
Hi.
I found so much that was so helpful for me, and I have a question.
Uh-huh.
Closer or what? Is that better?
Uh-huh. Thanks.
Okay. I work a lot with alcoholics in all different stages, and what I'd like information on is, realizing these things, which I totally agree with. These people, most of them, have no interest in religion, no close friends. They're killing themselves. So, people have said, you've done as much as you can, give up. But what can I do, or what can we do to help these people? No religion, no AA, killing themselves, truly.
Yeah. The most loving thing we can do is allow them the consequences of their behavior.
To die.
Well,
to die.
That could be one of the consequences.
Yeah.
It just tears your heart out. That's why there's Al-Anon. Because people get their heart torn out by trying to help, but see, the loved one, the one who loves an alcoholic is just as powerless as the alcoholic is.
Wow.
And there's nothing, and you're talking about friends or people around you.
Right.
When my heart really breaks is, I know guys and ladies in AA whose children now they see have the symptoms, because it is often genetic.
Right.
And they're having to see their children, and they know there's nothing they can do to stop it. I just lost my 35-year-old niece to this disease. we had had many, many talks. The family tried to do an intervention, so on and so forth. So you had all the information, but that doesn't do the trick. And some, it just tears our heart out.
What I was told is that they have to hit rock bottom. Okay. So they haven't. You know, so they say, if that doesn't work, give up.
Yeah.
So what they're saying to me is, give up. You've done as much as you can, and they haven't hit rock bottom.
Well, it just know what you can. If I had a broken arm, could you fix it?
I'd try.
Would you be successful?
No.
No.
So you give up?
Well, when you say give up, that's a loaded statement. But
I still
you recognize what you can do and what you can't do. So you give up doing something you can't do.
That's very hard to give up.
Oh, my God, is it hard. Anybody here that's in Al-Anon can tell you. That's why they go to Al-Anon.
I know.
It tears your heart out. It's very hard.
Yeah.
But if we don't do that, we'll get sicker than the alcoholic.
Okay.
The alcoholic can go to jail if they drink too much. The Al-Anon isn't going to go to jail if they love too much.
Right. But you can slowly see them killing themselves.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
Oh, believe me, I know.
Okay, thank
believe
you.
Believe me, I know. I mean, it is. Those are all the right words. But even that doesn't get into our, you know, doesn't get into our heart and stop the grieving. And we're not necessarily grieving someone who's died. We're grieving somebody that we see is on the way. It just is not easy. You know what's interesting is that there's probably about, I'm going to say 10%. These statistics, actually, if you'll just bear with me a second, I can tell you exactly what I want to say. Okay. 60 to 80 million people engage in risky alcohol use, but they don't have necessarily a disorder. About 2 million people, there's 20.5 million people who meet the criteria for alcohol dependency. 20.5 million. Yes, in the U.S. About 2 million people get appropriate treatment. Now, so about 10%, let's say. In Santa Barbara, there are over 200 AA meetings in the Santa Barbara area. Over 200 AA meetings in the Santa Barbara area. And they say that for every alcoholic, 4 are affected. In other words, qualify for Al-Anon. Well, how many Al-Anon meetings should there be? There are 80. 80. You see, the disease of Al-Anonism is even a disease of denial than... Because if I can get thrown in jail, I can get a medical problem, lose my business. Al-Anon people don't often, they just suffer inside. And when you suggest you should go to Al-Anon, they say, why should I have to go to a meeting? They're the ones that have the problem. And the Al-Anon talk about how hard it is to see an alcoholic die. It's really difficult to see an Al-Anon be miserable all of their life. Amazing statistics. That's come from a study of Peter McGoy, who's the primary counselor at Cottage Hospital, uses this. There's a study by the government. These are recent numbers. Yeah. Any other...
I'd just like to make a comment on what do you do when you see there's no more that you can do. I learned a great lesson from our speaker last week. Her name was Renzi Hernandez. She worked with Catholic Charities. And she never talked, Catholic worker, she never talked about what she did. And I tried to press her, you know, she had these, talked about these case histories. Well, what happened? What could you do for this person? She never said anything about what she did. And I finally got the message. She was just there. She stuck with them. Even, she said, there was nothing we could do. An undocumented alien. Nothing could be done for him. But she was there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think sometimes that's the hardest thing of all, is to realize your own helplessness and not want to pull away because you don't want to see it anymore, you don't want to look at it, but just to be there.
Yes, and remember I was talking about Thomas Keating defining God as presence, which means that if I'm present, God is present. So my being there is not just doing nothing, it's actually having the presence of God in the situation. And again, to let God do what God can do. As soon as I think I can take over, then we're in trouble. But that presence is a huge gift. And we don't have to be doing something to be present.
And the other thing that goes with this is, don't forget that everything and everyone that crosses your path, that comes into your life, can be a blessing and a teacher. And I think everyone here has experienced that it's usually the hardest things that are the greatest teachers and blessings.
Amen to that. All right.